This is in 2008, north side of Gaza Strip, 2008.
Well, 2008, just, what was the month? I'm sorry.
2008. It
March.
Was in the north.
This was
embark.
In the December.
I don't think
at,
so.
Okay.
No, it's yes. Not March.
So
no, for
how
sure.
Is
no.
It, how is it? You know, we got all these pictures and all these horrible, you know, photos that was taken during the Israeli attack on Gaza in December of 2008. How is it that we don't? You know, is there any way you can send this thing worldwide? Because this is. It seems that it's an everyday life of poor Palestinian people, but yet, you know, it's amazing that why can't we just get these things right there outside and so all these crimes be known to the rest of the world?
I got it to one of the, thanks for the question. I got it for one of the news agencies, not this photo, a lot of other photos and shots. And I say, well, why don't you show that in the American news? Papers and magazines, and one of the news editors in Jerusalem, he said to me, man, this is too much for Americans to see.
Who gives a damn about American
people? Right. Yeah, hold, okay, hold on. Okay, let's take someone over on this side of the room, the gentleman on the...
Yeah, I'm kind of a newcomer to what you're describing. I'm trying to understand the full context. You mentioned an Israeli disengagement. By that, I take it that the Israeli soldiers left Gaza, although they were on the perimeter. And following that, as I understand it, there were thousands of rockets that were shot without phone calls at Israel. Isn't that part of the context, or do you prefer not to speak of that?
That's a great question. I'd be very happy to answer that question, if that's okay. The Israeli narrative that we hear is that we left Gaza in 2005, and what thanks did we get from the Palestinians? They started firing thousands of rockets at us. This is really a very deceptive narrative, because the reality is that after 2005, Israeli fire into Gaza actually increased dramatically. And the number of deaths in Gaza increased sharply. So to give you an example, the Israeli figure, which is the standard figure according to them, there's no way to verify it independently, is that 8,000 projectiles were fired into the Gaza Strip between 2001 and 2008. And I can tell you that they're not harmless. In that period, 24 Israelis were killed. The first Israelis to be killed were killed on June 28, 2004. One of them was a little boy called Afik Zahavi, aged 4. And the second person to be killed was a 49-year-old man. So this isn't irrelevant, and the rockets are not harmless. But what the Israelis never talk about is what they are firing into the Gaza Strip. Some of that we've seen here, and not just firing, the bulldozing and destruction of homes and so on. There was a report by Human Rights Watch published in 2007 entitled Indiscriminate Fire. You can find it on the internet, that documented that between September 2005, the month after the so-called disengagement, that was in August 2005, so in the 18-month period from September 2005 until it was May 2007, Israel fired a total of 14,667 heavy artillery shells into the Gaza Strip, unlike Palestinian rockets, which are unguided, have very short range and carry a very small explosive charge, the Israeli munitions are highly accurate and very devastating with military high explosives. And the Human Rights Watch report, of course, documents the hundreds of Palestinians who are killed during that period, and in fact, thousands when you take the entire period since the so-called disengagement. That's, of course, not counting so-called targeted killings It's not counting the random sniper fire, which continues to kill people on a quite regular basis. I was struck 2 weeks ago when a rocket was fired into Israel, killing a migrant worker from Thailand. This was the first death caused by a rocket in some time. This was international news. It led the news on CNN, on the BBC World Service, and was occasion for international officials to make statements condemning Palestinian violence. Just a few days before that, actually a few weeks before that, three Palestinian workers were shot dead by Israeli snipers, just collecting what people do in Gaza is they collect rubble to try to rebuild homes because building supplies are not allowed in. We weren't able to find any major news media reports on their deaths. You could find it in the Palestinian media. You could actually even find it in the Israeli media. But it wasn't on the BBC and it wasn't on CNN. So I think that's really the context in which the story of 8,000 missiles has to be placed. And then you have to ask, well, if Israel is justified in firing back, so to speak, you have to ask what cheese factories, what mosques, what the Palestinian Legislative Council, what schools have to do with it. A stunning statistic. Of the 680 schools in the Gaza Strip, 18 were completely destroyed during Operation Cast Lead, and 280 were damaged. So half the schools in Gaza were damaged or destroyed in Israeli attacks in a three-week period. That can't have been an accident. The World Health Organization did a survey and found that of 122 health clinics in the Gaza Strip, 46% had been damaged or destroyed during Operation Cast Lead. Is Israeli fire really that inaccurate? We're told this is one of the most moral and ethical armies in the world, and that's just the beginning. So I think that's really the context in which we have to look at this. We'll move on. We have about 25 minutes, so we still have quite a lot to try to get through. So we'll come back to some of these things. But thank you for that excellent question. Mohammed, I felt like people needed to see this picture because of the story you told about what happened. I think it just shows some of the serendipity. You said it's a question of luck, and there's a particularly shocking story in terms of...
Yeah. Well, this is also in Rafah refugee camp, the southern part of the Gaza Strip. The three of them were alive. We were passing by those kids, and one of them, I believe, this boy who was there, he was telling us, you journalists must be seeing a lot of dead bodies and injured and killed. Come and tell us stories about what you see. We can make you tea or coffee. They were smoking, you can see here, cigarettes here, and drinking tea and coffee. Well, I said to them, well, we are really busy. We have to run now because it's very difficult and we have to file our photos now. So 10 minutes later, I get breaking news, SMS on my mobile, saying Israeli missile hit a crowd next to the United Nations UNRWA school in Rafah. We had to run back, all the journalists, to the area, and we found those who offered us to drink tea or coffee, they are all dead, as you can see in this image. We could be with them. It was a very tragic thing. Here is a boy, I remember, Abdul Halim, his name, and he's screaming over the body of his brother who was just killed. And it was just, this is the way when we arrived, what we saw exactly.
Khalina hki shwari an Rachel. I was just a couple of weeks ago in Olympia, Washington, which is the hometown of Rachel Corrie, who was the 23 years old when she was killed in Gaza on March 16th, 2003. And she was a young volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement and helping to defend Palestinian homes from demolition, these massive demolitions that you talked about. You actually knew Rachel.
Yes, that's true.
And you worked with her, or you?
Well, I have known Rachel quite well, actually. She was living with a family. Well, this photo is not really related to Rachel. Rachel wasn't with those guys.
But this is just the. This is similar to the area
it's
where she.
It's similar. Yeah. But there was. I mean, the only thing that they did is just. At this area, there is. You can see Jenny. She's from the International Solidarity Movement. She was coming there and with a microphone and holding the microphone, saying, "This is the Israeli army demolishing houses. Stop demolishing houses. We are going to report this back home." The driver of the bulldozer did not respond to her. He took the ruins of the house beneath her feet and take her all the way up and throw her away. That was Jenny. It wasn't the same incident of Rachel Corrie. It was, I think, a few weeks before that. And most of them were internationals coming from the United States, Britain, Italy, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Ireland, and many other countries.
But that was the kind of non-violent work Rachel was doing.
That was exactly the non-violent work of Rachel.
And you told me that the day Rachel was killed and she was effectively run over by an Israeli bulldozer, and incidentally her parents, Cindy and Craig, are going to be in Chicago on April 18th. There is going to be a hearing done by the American Friends Service Committee at Ida Noyes Hall at the University of Chicago, and there's information on that online. But Cindy and Craig Corrie are going to be in Chicago, and you can actually hear them. But they've just been in Israel because they are actually taking Israel to court to try to get some accountability in Rachel's death. The next picture is quite hard, but you felt it was important to show it because you told me that nobody believed you.
Nobody believed me until I sent that photo, when I stated, I called all the news agencies to say Rachel Corrie, American citizen, was just killed now.
I'm gonna put it up. It's quite a hard photo.
Nobody believed that, and then I start to get phone calls. Oh, she's not American. No, she's not American. She's Palestinian, and therefore you cannot get it on the news. You don't have. We are not going to treat it. So I take this photo and I sent it. One of those who was who asked me to send it is Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who asked me to send this photo, and he started to send it on to the news agencies at that day.
Yeah. And actually, the photos that we received that day were your photos. The first photos that we saw were the photos that you took. And the next one shows, it's difficult, but I actually found it quite moving as well. And the putting the American flag.
Putting the American flag over Rachel's body. This is at the hospital. This is the Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital. They are covering her body by the American flag. At that moment, from everywhere, hundreds of children are gathering around the hospital, and they want to see Rachel Corrie. And most of them, they were from something called the mini parliament, those kids actually. They were gathering and they made a symbol funeral for her, because her body had to be taken to the United States. And they immediately took the streets, calling for investigation, because they said, we have made a court, the Gaza children, and we found that Ariel Sharon, George W. Bush, and Tony Blair are war criminals, and she is one of the witnesses in this, and we want an investigation to be carried right now. I remember one of those children, she's about 8 or 9, she heard that one of the UNESCO presidents for the occupied Palestinian territories is arriving from Jerusalem. She said like this, the 9-year-old girl said, I'm not going to allow her to leave without listening to me, the story of Rachel Khoury, who is a witness. We want an investigation to come public. And this child was literally under the wheels of the jeep of the UNESCO, waiting for this lady to get out. And she said, well, you drive me, but you have to listen to me. There are two options. Either you drive over my body or you listen to me. And they really forced her. And she was able to listen to the stories of those children who took the streets immediately and are still protesting until today.
What struck me when I saw these pictures, Muhammad, is I'm not a fan of flags of any country. In general, I don't like to wave flags, but what really struck me is whenever we see images of the American flag in, among people of the Middle East, the images the media show, you know, people are burning it or walking on it, and what struck me is here they were really honoring it, and they were honoring Rachel, and I felt that was a picture that people should see.
Why are we sending our children to school? I think it's like the United States, to study and to become good citizens. Unfortunately, this is not the case in Gaza, where studying in a peaceful and quiet environment is something which is quite difficult. I arrived to Al Umariya Hospital. You have that photo? Next.
I'm not sure I do. Oh, yeah, I do. Yes, I'm sorry.
This is one of the places. It's Al Umariya School, southern part of the Gaza Strip, Rafah refugee camp. This is a school for the United Nations. What really struck me is this boy. I was trying to stop one of the kids. They were having English language class. That was the second class for the day. And two of the kids were shot in the head. They were killed by snipers. And by the way, these were the most professional snipers ever. As you can see, it cannot be by mistake, because all of them, they were shot there. And that was one of the most difficult situations, for everybody is running out of the school. We tried to stop one of them or two and to tell them, you know, we are just telling them, can you tell me the story of what happened? None of the children want to speak one word. All of them are just running out of the school. Horror, fear. They cannot just, because they say, oh, one of them is telling me, I saw the brain of my classmate, I saw him, I saw this, and then they are all traumatized, running out of the school. They don't want to talk. The only one who's left behind is this boy. He really doesn't want to leave the classroom. And this is the photo that I took from Al Umariya School, one of the United Nations school in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. This boy, I insisted to put this photo, because this boy, he said to me, I want to tell the American that we are suffering. And I told him, I promise you, I'm going to deliver your message.
Why don't we take, we have about 10 minutes, 12 minutes or so, and I would like to get some more questions from the audience. The lady in the center there, if the microphone can come over. And then the gentleman, I don't know if he's still there, there was a gentleman in this row, he left.
Muhammad, here are the pictures which are left. Which ones would you like to show? This question is for Mohammed.
You're the boss.
Okay. I'm sorry, can you...
Sorry, this question is for Mohammed. I was wondering, you know, you deal with such intense trauma and terror, and how do you stay sane? I mean, how do you process all this and not run around mad?
It's very complicated, I should say. It's very difficult under this situation in Gaza, but you know, I always, when I think of something, I always think of what is the alternative. I have no other alternative, really. I am not going to go and launch missiles or rockets towards Israel. That is not the way. Violence, it creates violence, and it's all just nonsense. For me, the best way to do it is through serious commitment to journalism. And I'm going to continue that as long as I'm alive.
Let's take another one. Let's see, we'll try to get to the far reaches of the room. The gentleman in the back here, yeah, and then we'll go to that side.
Thank you. This question is for both Mohammed and Ali. I guess, what can we do to end this brutality? And I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. What does he say?
The question is, what can we do to end this brutality? You want me to answer that? Well, this will take a lot longer than 12 minutes,
this
so I'm going to have to.
This is a new lecture, by the way.
Yes. Well, I think that that being in Chicago, there's a lot of educational opportunities in Chicago. I mentioned the event on the 18th, and there's a couple of other events going on in Chicago. The Chicago Palestine Film Festival is starting on April 16th at the Gene Siskel Film Center downtown. So get the program from them. But beyond education and bringing people, the opportunities for action, I think, are really growing. There is a growing global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement modeled on the anti-apartheid movement of the 1980s that says the basic premise in a sentence is our governments, our international institutions have failed to hold Israel accountable. We are complicit because we are paying for this, we are assisting it politically, we're turning a blind eye, we're even encouraging it. And so it's up to international civil society to hold Israel accountable, to change the balance, to be in solidarity with Palestinians so they have options other than violence. If they have sources of power, grassroots power from civil society, then people don't need violence because they're powerful. Those are some of the things very generally. To some of the ways you can get educated about the BDS movement is go to bdsmovement.net. We publish quite a lot on the Electronic Intifada. That's one of the things I'm involved in with many other people is the Electronic Intifada. And you can learn about some of the actions that are going on. Does anyone know of any upcoming actions in Chicago that they would like to mention in 10 seconds or less that people can get involved in?
They're calling the White House every second day and also calling our Congress people.
That's very important too. And did you have something on that, on an action that's going on? Yeah? Yeah, and I'm going to say when we end, I'm going to invite those who have actions or organizations they're involved in to go over to the books table, buy lots and lots of books, and also talk to each other, and you can exchange information about some of the ways to get involved. Let's take another question right here. Yes, just wait for the microphone, please.
If I'm remembering this right, ask one more. As far as Israeli aid goes, the last time that we withheld aid from Israel because of the settlements was under Ronald Reagan. Is that correct?
The United States has never withheld aid because
no,
of
Ronald,
the settlements.
Ronald Reagan
George
withheld.
Bush withheld George no. Bush the first withheld some loan guarantees briefly, but it was more cosmetic than.
I think Reagan withheld aid. He was the only president that ever withheld aid, and it was because they wouldn't stop building settlements.
I'm not aware of that. But
and I'm wondering if that would be some way we can go, because that is so much in the press now about the settlements in Jerusalem and stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's something people have to ask their representatives for. This picture, I don't know if people can see the die. She's holding up her finger with the die, right? She voted. That was do you remember that was the 2005 or 2006 election?
This was 2006. I accidentally saw the lady, and then she said, "I wish if I didn't vote."
You saw her afterwards, because
I asked her what's happened. Oh, I saw you, and then she said, "Oh, okay, mom, yeah, I remember, yes. I wished if I didn't vote. You see that what voting brought us destruction to our house."
Yeah. The other picture that you had a whole series of pictures that I wish we had time to show that document really the role of women in the struggle and steadfastness. And I just picked one of them. And I wanted to make sure that we hear the story behind this picture. Do you want to use the pointer?
Yeah, well, the story is basically there is a hidden tank here, as you can see here. And this was in November 2006, during the war in Lebanon. Sorry, that was after the war in Lebanon. The war in Lebanon was in the summer. At this attack, I do remember very well that Israel called through a microphone. They called on every man between the age 14 and 45, get out of the house and gather inside the United Nations school nearby or the agricultural school in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia. As long as you hear this announcement, you cannot avoid it. If you are a man between this group, you cannot say I'm a prestigious university professor and I'm not going to show up, or I'm too busy, I have to write my own essays or articles and I don't have. No, that's not possible. Every man who is between this age should get out of the house immediately and gather in there. What's going to happen? Some of them will be tortured, some will be arrested, and most of them, they handcuff them and they close their eyes and they keep them like in lines, like there is like a few thousand men, and they keep them in lines under the sun for a number of hours. Some of them, they did really manage to escape. And I can tell you, there were around 62 or 63 men who did not listen to the call of the microphones. And they decided not to stay in the house, but to go to hide in one of the mosques.
Everybody in the whole Gaza Strip?
That is an area. That is a limited area. If they are attacking the northern part of the Gaza Strip, then they specify it and they tell you that you have to go out of there. And some of these situations were two brothers, they managed at that attack, when I took this photo and then we got the news that two brothers, they were asked together in one of the schools and they were released. On the way back, they were shot by other troops. 62 men, or 63, they refused to go inside. They hide inside a mosque. Israel immediately start to spread the rumors through Red Cross. Sometimes we get to know information through the Red Cross. We call Mr. Nasser, who's their spokesman, and say, well, what's happening? He tell us that Israel is threatening now to bomb the mosque if those men are not allowed, are not to get out of the mosque. Women heard the story immediately. They break into the mosque. They managed to bring all the men outside, and they managed to free all of them. But unfortunately, most of those who were there, 19 women, were injured and 3 women were killed at that day.
And that there's been a couple of other incidents.